Welcome to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. Conversations focused on how some of the world's top energy leaders are innovating to deliver clean, affordable, and reliable energy for the future.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. We're excited to be back and have a wonderful guest, Neil Brown. Neil is the Managing Director of the Progressive Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., where he co-leads PPI's Energy and Climate Solutions Initiative. In that role, he engages in with stakeholders in Congress and beyond to develop pragmatic energy and climate policies. Before PPI, Mr. Brown founded an advocacy communications firm, Allegius Media, I believe. You can correct me, Neil. And then spent 7 years working on Capitol Hill on political campaigns and things like that. He frequently writes and speaks on market-based bipartisan approaches to climate and energy issues, including the recent PPI report on environmental justice, which I think we're going to dig into today. Neil, thank you very much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Adam. Pleasure to be here.
And Stuart, Brian, good to see you guys again as well.
Thank you.
Good to be on.
So, Neil, we always start off the podcast with something to just kind of get to know our guests a little bit better. And I see some music posters in the background there. So let's clear the air. What sort of music is on your playlist right now? I see some Stevie Wonder. I see some looks like folk music. What are you listening to today?
Yeah, I have to admit, I am an avid bluegrass musician. And so when I'm not doing policy work, I'm playing guitar, playing bass, singing in some bands, some country music as well. So a lot of that's on my list all the time. So that's why I work, so I can play music.
Got to have the why, right? Got to have the why. Well, good. Well, let's dive right in. Stuart, you want to kick us off there?
Yeah, no, I can. I guess I'll start with, you know, I'm in D.C. Neil, I think you're down the street from me here in D.C. A lot of conversation is happening about permitting reform. And so I guess just share a little bit about what you are doing, what your organization's doing to highlight kind of the need for permitting reform and for policymakers to take a focus on permitting reform.
Yeah, my focus here on that has been lately, you know, it's really driven by this paper that Adam mentioned earlier on the cost of energy and what effects that has on voters. And that to me is the driver of the need for permitting reform. I mean, at the end of the day, when we need more supply into these markets that have high demand, where prices are rising, where people are really feeling the effects, we need to be able to build the infrastructure we need to meet those demands. You know, as you all know, energy markets are incredibly complicated creatures, and they're different in every state, in every region, sometimes localities. But at the end of the day, when you don't have enough supply to meet the demand, your prices are going to go up. And so we kind of try to boil it down to that as a general idea here. So no matter what market you're in, if you're not hitting those marks, we need to find better ways to do that. Better ways for government to deliver, make investments in that infrastructure predictable for companies. It doesn't always have to be easy, but it needs to be predictable. And I think that's what good permitting reform will do, is give companies that ability to make those investments in the infrastructure we need. And that's kind of the direction I come from on permitting reform and what drives me to advocate for that.
Oh, that's good. Adam, you might be muted.
I'm sorry, guys. A newbie mistake there. I'm coming off a cold. I didn't want to cough in everyone's ear. It's an interesting strategy, right? One that I tend to agree with. You know, I know that we didn't prep on this question, but I've been dealing with a lot of AI stuff and all the new data centers and things like that. I mean, can you speak to or have you experienced how that is influencing any of this report or what you're doing today?
Sure. It's a real tough balancing act that we're facing. We're looking at predictions for just tremendous load demand in our future. If any of these predictions are even partially true, we've got a lot. We got to build a lot of production. We got to build a lot of transmission to meet those demands. Our choices are pretty simple. We can build that to meet that demand, continue to lead the world in AI, to get ahead of our geopolitical adversaries who are equally trying to do the same thing, or we can put the brakes on it and let them go. And I think that would be a mistake that the U.S. wouldn't recover from anytime soon. I think, and you know, it's what has driven our economy for decades and decades. It's innovation, meeting those demands. And so I don't think this is a time to stop that in the face of what could be a kind of society changing technology we need to stay on top of. So to me, again, it's a simple choice what we have to do. It's a hard thing to do after we make that.
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch. I mean, people moved to behind the meter and just all the gas that they're using and things like that. It's interesting.
Yeah, and we, you know, how to, you know, keep those, you know, all the behind the meter work that's going on, how to find ways to connect that into the grid, get that transmission infrastructure built out so that they can be good grid citizens as well as we're getting at. So, you know, industry bears a responsibility here as well to carry that burden, to build those things out, to be good citizens to other, you know, consumers on the grid.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, not a government fixes everything, but we all play a part in this. And I think, you know, as long as we've got that goal in mind, that we're not putting the brakes on and pulling back and trying to undo the innovations we have. We're all rowing in the same direction.
So, Neil, I read the PPI report. First, I looked at it. I think it was like 118 pages and didn't think I'd get through it all, but I realized most of it was appendixes. So, No, it's great data. Hopefully, we can put a link to it on the show notes so everybody can look at it. But it's just kind of a fascinating report, honestly, on some of that stuff. And one of the things that stuck out to me as we're speaking about infrastructure and what companies can do to help that. The note in there about New England supply, just for those who don't know, they took Boston, kind of New England area as a case study for this report, but their supply of gas comes through a set of 6 pipelines and that it's all liquefied natural gas. And just coming from Oklahoma, living in Texas, I could probably go outside and throw a rock and it would throw over more than 6 pipelines in the ground. And so that's just, it's kind of fascinating to me. And it showcases that on, you know, LNG, I think it's obviously more expensive a product, right, than just a gas pipeline. And then the other fact on there that was mentioned about it having to come from abroad because of domestic transportation, which is just kind of bonkers to me that's going on. So, you know, that being said, to try and get more energy infrastructure in areas like that are kind of siloed for things, I know a lot of it talking about permitting regulatory aspects of that. Is there kind of a silver lining on some of this stuff or something that can be done broadly speaking that could help that?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're seeing some movement. I mean, we published this paper in February this year, but our conversation started probably about it a year ago now with members of the Congressional Black Caucus and some industry folks and trying to get our heads around what's going on here on cost. We chose Boston because it is kind of the pinnacle case of what really driving hard to get rid of fossil fuels in a market does and what it has done there. Like you said, very few pipelines coming in. About 10% of their gas comes in from Trinidad and Tobago. 10% of their imported gas comes in from Trinidad and Tobago. That's not, that's a carbon intensive procedure there to liquefy the gas, take it on a ship up. And because of the Jones Act, and that's a whole nother show we can do. Mm-hmm. You can't get, U.S. port to U.S. port transportation on LNG vessels unless they're flagged U.S. and crewed U.S. And there are not that many of those. What that's done to Boston, it means no new gas supplies are coming in. There was a transmission line, I'm sure you guys know about it, trying to bring hydropower down from Canada. And that was delayed and delayed and finally canceled it. And so again, not even renewable energy coming into Boston. All their eggs were in the offshore wind basket. Now the Trump administration is pulling the rug out from under those projects as well. So it's now in a rising demand market with already high prices and no way to get new supply in. So there are no other levers to pull to get supply in. And so that demand lever is very expensive. And what we are looking at is when those policies decisions are made to get a city into that position, where those costs fall. And this is our report where we mapped out energy burdens, which is the percentage of income that people spend on utilities. And we mapped that with the Black population in Boston. And it is almost the same map. And so, you know, it's, and I'll just mention this other kind of paradox to, that we found, I found was one of the most fascinating things. When you look at our map of the Eastern Seaboard, you see the carbon emissions per household. It is a red map all the way up and down the Eastern Seaboard, except for these little green islands, which is Boston, New York, Baltimore, D.C. Cities are the most efficient places to live in a per household carbon emission basis. So these are families living in the most efficient places to live, being kind of saddled with the cost of a global climate solution, policy solution. And that's being saddling that burden on the people in those cities that can least afford it in those communities. And so what we've looked at is kind of how do we change the conversation on environmental justice to really focus on that key point, because what those high costs mean to those families is having to choose between food and paying utility bills, having to choose between medicine and paying utility bills, getting shutoff notices. You know, these can have generational effects on families in these areas. It's not just an inconvenience as it would be for more affluent neighborhoods. If you're getting your power cut off because you forgot to pay your bill, they can't get it turned back on. They have to move. They have to get something turned on in a relative's name. Just incredible cost there. Heard just terrible stories about families who don't have enough. The power gets turned off. They can't wash clothes. You got teenage kids in the house. They don't go to school. Truancy rates rise. I mean, these are kind of follow-on repercussions of the high prices of utilities in these cities. So it's not just pollution, which is an incredibly important part of the environmental justice conversation. Particulate matter pollution, NOx and SOx pollution, absolutely critical. Carbon emissions is not an environmental justice issue on the local level in the degree that pollution and cost are. And so we're trying to reevaluate what that looks like. Saddling these communities with a global climate problem does not seem just.
Thanks for sharing, Neil. Just curious. I mean, we can come back to it, but want to hear a little bit from you too, just about how does, you know, fingers crossed, permitting reform happens, infrastructure gets built, but what are other ways that, might be getting some feedback here, but I'll mute after I talk, after I ask my question, but just curious if you can share other ways about, you know, what are utilities doing to help consumers with energy bills? What are, you know, infrastructure companies, midstream companies like their RGPA doing? I mean, what other options are there out there and what other things are being worked on?
Yeah, I think some important parts of this equation are the LIHEAP program. You know, this is a longstanding program that helps low-income families pay those energy bills. It is currently under attack under this administration, and some of the budgets being presented, they've been zeroed out. A lot of the staff that administer that program have been laid off. You know, this, even if we got everything we wanted on permitting tomorrow and we started building everything we need, these families are still going to suffer until all that supplies reaches the market and those prices come down. And again, you know, that can mean, again, generational harm to families just in that time. So even if in best case scenario, we've got to have these programs, we've got to have support for people to pay those bills. It's in their interest. It's in utilities' interests. They don't want to be shutting power off to families in the wintertime. You know, nobody wants that. So LIHEAP's essential. I think having those supports there that, you know, people can rely on to meet those basic needs that we have. Other things that the industry can do, I mean, you know, the industry has been, at least in for the most part, making commitments on emissions, lowering emissions for methane in pipelines and transport, maintaining those commitments, even in a policy climate that may not reward that right now, sends a very strong signal that the industry means what they say when they're doing these projects. They care about the communities they're serving. They care about the environment that we're leaving to our kids. that I think is an incredibly important piece of this equation. As we're seeing, to go back to the Boston example, we're seeing some movement. It's the governor, Hochul, showing some openness to opening pipeline or building pipelines. We're seeing some movement when Democratic circles to build out the fossil fuel industry, the fossil fuel infrastructure we need as we build more with renewables, gas, with renewables and solar and wind, storage, all these things we need, acknowledging that gas can play a major role in that ecosystem of energy and meeting those requirements. But again, the climate, the policy climate we're in now with this administration, we're seeing a lot of that kind of go away in the renewable side. I think the industry showing its resolve and maintaining those things is really important. As you know, the industry looks at 20, 30 year timelines. 4 years is not a big chunk of time here. That longer time horizon, showing good faith that you're doing the things you said you're going to do, makes a big difference as we go forward.
Yeah, I mean, you've talked about kind of both sides of the aisle, right? Bipartisan approach. You know, and here we get a pretty broad stroke of people that listen, you know, a couple, you know, folks that don't know anything about the energy industry. And then we got people that, you know, work that are our coworkers that listen, just their kind of relationships to us. But, you know, suppose the leader of a midstream company, you know, reads the report right today. Are there specific strategies that they should consider with approach on energy? I think you mentioned sticking kind of with those emissions goals and things like that, but how can pipeline and storage operators and those that can genuinely help lower the energy burden, how can they, you know, what decisions would we like to see being made to help that out?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, communicating is a big part of this. You know, communicating that commitment to emissions reductions, very valuable. I think talking to lawmakers, to local communities, when you're building in these communities, lots of good communication there. We've got some suggestions in our paper on both how to do better community engagement from a government side, but that also includes, you know, being able to having industry connect with the communities and with lawmakers. One of my soapboxes I often get criticized for by some lawmakers is encouraging, you know, decision makers to talk to people in the industry, to talk to people in the fossil fuel industry. And I'm talking to Democrats who, you know, often have their door closed. We don't talk to, we don't make healthcare policy without talking to doctors. We have to engage with people that know how to make the energy. And I learned more talking with folks like you about how you produce and deliver the energy we need every day. It informs me, it informs my decision-making and what I can recommend. And I encourage policymakers. And that means outreach to people that you may not normally agree with. You don't have to agree with them, but having, you know, civil conversations, I do actually welcome those, you know, with people I don't agree with. It's good for the dialogue. It's unfortunately more of a rare occasion, a rarity here in this town than it used to be, but we try to encourage that. And I think some of the stories that I've heard some pipeline companies talk about what these delays mean to communities, you know, when they get a protest for irregular maintenance on a pipeline from an environmental group and they slow down the maintenance on a pipeline for 2 years. It doesn't decrease any emissions, doesn't reduce anything going into the atmosphere that wouldn't, if the pipeline was empty or full. What it does do is reduce the amount of fuel going into that community and leads to greater prices. It leads to, you know, costs being passed on to ratepayers out of just the symbolism. And I think some of those stories were news to policymakers when they hear somebody protesting a pipeline and they have a completely different issue or, you know, set of issues in their head on what that means. So again, in these conversations, sharing those stories, both in communities, what it means to them when this is happening in their communities, and with policymakers and what it means to them.
You mentioned you're hearing more of a middle ground, right, on the Hill and in your day to day. But, you know, we hear the same thing, right? There's people who support very aggressive expansion, but also a full stop, right? And so, you know, what do you think is the best way to drive that policy and maybe help some folks have the conversations that you're having where they can understand affordability, reliability, which we've talked about a lot on this podcast as well, and emissions reductions? I mean, how do you kind of approach that when you know someone is staunchly for or staunchly against this pretty polarizing issue here?
Yeah, well, I mean, fortunately, I think it's the same story right now. When I'm addressing folks that are far to my left and talk about affordability and the need for supply to meet the demands and lower costs, I can now have that same conversation with people on the farther right that are trying to, you know, impede production of renewable energy.
Yeah,
we've got to have this. True. I mean, there's no space in this equation to cut out, you know, the energy that we need and the investments that companies have made in these. They've made long-term commitments, invested billions of dollars in these projects. You know, we need the supply to keep prices down to meet those increasing demands. So again, it's the same story for me anyway, no matter who I'm talking to here on how we get there. I see, you know, the Trump administration really just recently this week pulling the plug on some carbon capture projects. Again, you know, if we're looking on ways to meet demand with the infrastructure that we have now, we've got to have these sorts of technologies to do that. And, you know, the folks on the left don't like carbon capture because they think it increases the length of time that fossil fuel industry will be in business. But, you know, I don't see the problem if we can burn natural gas and have no emissions from it. Problem is there. So, you know, again, I think some of the confusion comes down to, at least on the left, getting rid of fossil fuels versus lowering emissions. They're not always the same thing. And sometimes trying to get rid of fossil fuels will lead to an increase in emissions, as we point out in Boston, where they're burning fuel oil and, you know, bringing in LNG from abroad ends up increasing both pollution and carbon emissions when you don't have any other options there.
Interesting.
So, Neil, this may be kind of an impossible question to answer, but we've been talking about polarization, right? There's fundamental misunderstandings, I think, on both sides of energy industry and how energy's consumed and what the emissions are and how they emit and all those kinds of things. And we've kind of, it seems to me, the last several presidential terms, the branch of government, the legislative branch that, you know, would normally be in charge of setting policy and laws and things like that seems to be kind of absent on a lot of these things. And it's kind of the executive administrative branch that's coming out with executive orders and policy changes on that end. And they're not, to me, that effective, right? Because they just kind of get reversed and swapped back and forth. And then we're kind of stuck in the middle. So I was looking up congressional approval ratings, about 26% right now. And we have a lot of information polls and things of kind of the typical working class American. I think they're more middle of the road, right? They appreciate the energy that they can get to get to lower costs. They also appreciate renewable energy, right? For environmental purposes. I mean, I don't think that's an uncommon stance, but what you don't see is that kind of voice and action kind of in our government. So I guess the impossible question is, as you've been talking with members of Congress, you know, things like that, is there any impetus and reaction from them on, first of all, understanding that from their constituency and people, and then just a move to actually make a difference and actually try and get some laws or some things passed?
Yeah, you're right. That's a tough one. I'll give you a couple of examples from just conversations I've had when we walked around with this paper, where we met every congressional Black caucus district, the energy burdens and Black population in their districts. And we went around to many of these offices. A lot of the leadership in the Congressional Black Caucus met with members and their staff. This was enlightening information for them. And no one has been having this conversation with them. And so I think facing this in that way, I've seen a lot of movement and willingness to entertain these issues in a different way than I've seen before. And so I think opening this door to talk about affordability has helped. It continues to help. This entire year, flying around the country, talking to different groups about this. And, you know, I've yet to find a group that wasn't interested in talking about it as we dig in. You know, as an example of what the progress, the kind of hope that I have, it was an op-ed, I believe, in today's New York Times, an opinion piece by the New York Times editorial board, saying that, you know, I mean, it goes after Trump primarily about getting rid of renewable projects. But right up front, in I think the second paragraph, it says, you know, recognize that using natural gas as part of a solution is the right way to go in combination with renewables, wind, solar, geothermal. And I'm paraphrasing, I don't have it sitting here in front of me right now, but to me, you wouldn't have read that a year ago.
And yeah, so that's probably something I never would have read.
Something has changed kind of fundamentally in the conversations we're having now that we weren't having before. So there's hope. At least I see the left kind of moving into a position that we can at least have a rational conversation about fossil fuels and what those emissions look like, where we can improve, how we can do better, and what we need. We just have to have that same conversation to the right of center on what renewables mean. They're not the answer to everything. And I think the left is coming to grips with that as well. They are also not the worst thing in the world. And the right needs to come to grips with that. We need all of these pieces together as Americans to make this work. And I think there's some hope. I think it's a good position to have if we can kind of get over that hump of everybody picking their favorite fuel and, you know, pointing their finger at everybody else, then we might be able to make some progress here. So I've got some hope, which is not something you hear every day here.
Definitely.
Neil, to kind of maybe dig into it a little bit more in terms of what's making costs go up, could you talk a little bit about LNG exports? How does that impact domestic costs of natural gas?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard this raised quite a bit over the last few years. We do a lot of work about LNG abroad. I just got back from a long trip to Germany, talking with some folks there, and I'm there quite often talking about this issue. I mean, look, you know, we as Americans now, and I was just talking about this morning. I'm going to point to my age a little bit. Most of my life, the United States has been dependent on foreign actors for our energy. And we crossed a point, you know, in the recent past where we're no longer that. We are, you know, producing energy here so much so that we're exporting it. And that kind of passed without much fanfare. You know, we're no longer kind of hostage to malign actors around the world to get our energy. That should be celebrated. We are also now producing enough that we can help others around the world not be reliant on those same people. Are the same countries. In the United States and our natural gas supplies here saved Europe after Russia invaded Ukraine. I hate to think of what would have happened that winter had we not been able to supply Europe with that natural gas that they needed to heat their homes. So that's the geopolitical positive for it. It is a legitimate question on whether that raises prices here in the United States. Do we have enough to sustain that? We've been doing this now for a while. We've been past that hump and exporting huge amounts. And we've seen the international spot price stay pretty level, with the exception of the invasion of Ukraine, where it spiked pretty high. But that was not a product of us exporting more than we should. That was a hopefully once in a lifetime exercise that we went through there. So I don't see the evidence now that, you know, these exports are driving prices up. Certainly something that we need to be cognizant of. If we ever get to the point that we are exporting more than we can supply to the world and not meet our needs. Right now, our bigger concern is we can't get the supplies into our cities from right next door. When we're looking at Boston, is just a few hundred miles from one of the largest natural gas reserves in the world, and we can't get a pipeline run over there to, you know, get the supply they need in that area. So I'm more concerned with our domestic supplies, getting the pipeline infrastructure where it needs to be, getting those renewable projects built out where they need to be, than I'm worried about us sending off too much gas around the world at this point.
Yeah, it's an interesting conundrum there. We talked a lot about infrastructure. What else can we do to help, you know, consumers lower their energy prices and save on energy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we focused a lot on the supply side in this paper and a lot of what we've been talking about this last year. Obviously, on the demand side, finding policies that help people reduce their emissions is important. I mean, look, we're in the center-left think tank. I don't know if I mentioned that before, but we really work with centrist Democrats here. We as Democrats have to do better about those policies as well. and kind of where they're targeted and how they're targeted. You know, we look at the Biden administration, one of the, you know, kind of marquee, again, you know, demand side policies is the EV tax credit, $7,500 to buy a new electric car.
Mm-hmm.
That's great for me. I got a new car. I got paid money to get a new car. It was fantastic. You know, we have the same thing for heat pumps and other efficient, you know, I get paid money to get new stuff for my house. This is all upside for me. I'm financially incentivized to buy into this narrative and feel good about myself for doing it. What we haven't thought of is what message we're sending to those poor communities in around the country, working class families. You look at the average net worth of Black families in this country is $44,000. So essentially what we're saying is, if you'll just spend your entire net worth on this new car, you're good. You know, you're doing good things for the environment. I don't think anybody's asking any of us on this call to spend our entire net worth on any global project. And I think we'd be offended if they did. We're finding that working class families are quite offended that we have been asking them to do this.
Interesting.
We've got to find a better way to incentivize and help people get more efficient equipment in their homes, find ways to make those working class homes more efficient, but economical, help them lower their bills. You know, and it has the byproduct of lowering emissions as well. But we can't do it by asking, you know, unbeknownst to us as we put the policy out there, what it looks like to the people in these working class communities is you're asking me to give up everything. And I can't do that. And on top of that, they feel shamed by certain corners of the community that are pushing for this, that they're not doing the right thing, that they've got to drive a, you know, pickup truck to their work, that they're looked down upon for this. And so one of the projects here at PPI, we're looking at, you know, how do we address all of our issues here, particularly in energy, for working class voters, to help them. As you pointed out earlier, these are not climate deniers. They understand the importance of this issue. They just don't want to pay for all of it and don't want to be asked to pay all their money to fix it. So, you know, we're working hard with policymakers, elected officials to address those issues in ways that resonate with voters.
Yeah, that's an interesting story. I mean, how do those kind of initiatives or efforts that you're doing tie into some of the infrastructure fixes? I mean, is there information going out about, hey, they might put in a pipeline, but it might help you out, or it might, you know, help the community and things like that? I mean, what, how do those complement each other, I guess?
Those are engagements we're having, you know, both with elected officials. So we'll go in and say, what, you know, here's the map of the district. We're doing the same project with Congressional Hispanic Caucus members. It's a different story everywhere, right? So we go into the office, here's your district, here's the Black population, here's the Latino population, here's the, you know, the energy burden in your district. It's happening here, you know, and getting a dialogue going back and forth. And this, I think, is, you know, we're doing on a small scale here. We go around to members of Congress and have these conversations, but I think it informs them as they go back to their district. They look at those projects that are being proposed in their areas, and they have a new frame of reference there and who this affects and well, how. And so, I mean, for industry folks listening to this, is having those kinds of conversations with members, not just going in and saying, you know, we need this in your district now, you know, it's, give it to us. And that's the first time they've seen your face. It may be the last time they see your face. But going in to talk about what this means for jobs, what this means for small businesses and their energy bills, what this means for innovation, you know, how does this help those communities? How does this help those cities in these areas? And that's a lot of work. You know, none of this is easy, but, you know, I think it's necessary to have those conversations. And I think that's where that that change can be.
So triggered for me with the word heat pump. I won't get too much into it, but like I said, I live in DC, have a heat pump. It's still cold in my house sometimes. But I mean, I think, you know, you hear the term all of the above when you think about supply. But I thought you made a good point about maybe we should talk about all of the above when we talk about demand. And I think that's one of the things that's always kind of been baffling to me is like, why are you telling all these people that live in like South Florida to put heat pumps in? You know, I mean, maybe that's a bad example because, you know, heat pumps do air conditioning, but like, why are you going to have some ultra high efficiency furnace if you're in Florida and your furnace only runs like 2 months out of the year? Like, I guess maybe talk a little bit about, is there a conversation happening on the demand side about all of the above?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we have these, again, going back to kind of, you know, weatherization programs that help low-income families, you know, go in, weatherize their homes. Oftentimes, it's not practical. Some of these homes are, you know, especially in these big cities, you know, it's just not practical sometimes to weatherize some of these places. So I think rather than mandating that people do these sorts of things, we need to find ways to communicate to people and not moralizing against people that can't do this. Ways to, you know, I think it was a failure of our marketing departments at our auto industries that electric cars aren't cooler than they are. I think there was a real opportunity there for market-led innovations there to drive that. And I think that's the case. When we start seeing highly efficient appliances be affordable and efficient and good things to have in your house and make sense for your home, we'll start seeing people buy them without us having to subsidize that. We can drive it from the market. Hybrid cars are very popular because they get people over that anxiety of range and things like that. Still efficient. We should be pushing policies that advocate for hybrid cars. And we don't do that because there are a lot of environmentalists don't like them because they still use gasoline. But they're better than driving a 15-year-old car. Again, you know, as of all these things, having the perfect get in the way of the good is often a problem we have to my left politically, that we've got to figure out better ways to do that and address those demand sides from saying, okay, this may not be the best vehicle you could drive, but it's better. And so let's get behind that. Let's find ways that we can allow the market to push efficiency that's, you know, that's actually good for your home. I mean, again, to harken back to my trips to Germany, I mean, they did this big push to mandate people get heat pumps. And it, you know, went about as well as could be expected. They got pummeled. They, you know, the Greens took a beating on this and had to backtrack. And, you know, it just was insensitive to what people need, what people wanted, what people could afford. And so we've got to pay attention to all those things and hopefully let the market kind of play a more prominent role in this, have the government policy help, but let the market drive this.
Yeah, I mean, once you're kind of wrong, you kind of lose the attention, right? Not wrong, but I mean, once
yeah. People
get that perception, right?
Yeah. Yes.
If it makes anyone feel better, I have a hybrid that has 390,000 miles, so yeah. They do work very well. Trying to get 400, I'm very close. So, Neil, the report had a ton of great information on. I'm sure it took a long time and a lot of work to build that, and it's good to hear that as you're sharing that information, it's kind of opened some eyes of some folks and get them to kind of realize what is actually happening to some folks out there with a lot of heavy energy burden. Last question, I think if there was a key takeaway message that you'd like to share to all the listeners, just kind of summarize it up, what would you say that is about this report and what we can do?
That's tough. I mean, it kind of touches on everything. We hit all the high points here. You know, I think paying attention to affordability, making sure we have supply that meets the demands that we have. And look, environmental justice is incredibly important. We're not dismissing the idea of that in this paper, just a kind of looking at it in a little different lens to where cost is incredibly important. But look, I think, you know, we all have a role to play here. I think as policymakers, as industry, and moving in the same direction. A lot of folks in the industry are going to be a lot closer to people in this administration, Republican members. If you think that an all the above strategy is the right thing, you know, talk to them about what renewables mean and all of the above. Even coming from somebody who works in the pipeline industry, and you walk in and you want to talk to them about making sure that we can get wind deployed offshore to help the burden in some of these cities as you're building pipelines in. I think that's incredibly valuable. So, because we're doing it here at PPI, we're talking to the folks on our left and having very candid conversations about what we think that means. And they're, you know, it's not an easy conversation all the time. So I would encourage you to talk, whether you're Democrat or Republican, to talk to your members, talk to your local officials, because local permitting is also an issue here at state, and carry a broad message, not just, hey, what about my pipelines? But hey, what about all the supply we need into these cities to keep prices down and meet the demands that we're looking at?
And it's good to know that conversation is happening a little bit more easily recently. Well, Neil, we like to wrap up the show with the same question for everybody. And I hope this happens. In this case, it's been a really enlightening conversation. You know, you're back on the show. It's 3 years from now and you're happy. You know, things are going good. What has gone on over the past three years that has caused you to be happy?
Well, if we want to stick with the report here, that we see some new supply into Boston, we see some wind farm deployments off the coast of Boston, and bringing new supply in, maybe even a line down, you know, at least in the planning stages to get some hydropower down in there, and then we start seeing some prices being lowered and some relief to some of these families in Boston, in those neighborhoods that are hit the hardest by that. You know, I think we are at a critical point here, and that I think we can shift to a pragmatic way forward on energy policy that brings people together. And that's oftentimes hard for partisans to grapple with because they need a win. But I think it's a win for Americans if we can get this moving forward. And that would make me very happy. So
awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time and the conversation. I believe we'll definitely try and link the report on our podcast here. And thank you very much again. I appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure, and great to meet you all.
Thank you for listening to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. If you like what you have heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast @gmail.com.